All right, everybody, welcome to the weekend interview show for Saturday, August the 28th. I will be out of town this weekend, so we are recording this interview on Thursday, the 26th of August, 2004. The guest today is Ivan Elin. He's the former principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office, evaluator in charge at the General Accounting Office, investigator for the House Foreign Relations Committee, and director of foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. He is currently the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute and is the author of the books Putting Defense Back into U.S. Defense Policy and his newest, The Empire Wears No Clothes. Welcome to the show, Mr. Elin.
Thank you.
It's an honor to have you on, sir.
It's great to be here.
I should say, first of all, in the news I noticed before I left the house today that al-Sistani is back in Iraq from London and is on his way to Najaf to hopefully broker a truce between the militia surrounding Muqtada al-Sadr and the U.S. Marine Corps. What do you make of the situation going on in Najaf right now, sir?
Well, I am not up to the latest minute on it, but it seemed like a lot of the al-Sadr's fighters were not going to pay attention to al-Sistani. They say that they're loyal to al-Sadr. Now, whether al-Sadr will pay attention to al-Sistani is another matter. So, I don't know. This is going to be a complex situation here. Al-Sistani has been working with the coalition. In fact, he went to London probably while this onslaught was underway. So that
he kind of left town as cover, huh?
Well, he went to – he had real angioplasty heart procedure in London, but I think he timed it so that he could be away for most of this. But I think now they're sending him back because they haven't been able to reach any conclusion. I mean, the United States is somewhat up the creek here because they can't take the shrine themselves or there'll be outrage all over the country that an infidel presence is in one of the sacred Shiite holy sites, in fact, probably the most important one. And they can't rely on the Iraqi security forces because they're in such abysmal shape that, it would be hard-pressed to do it, and that's what's caused the problem. Now, they may end up using the Iraqi forces, but if they do, it's very risky because you don't know what these people will do under pressure. The U.S. forces are highly trained, but have the problem of being the wrong religion, and the people who have the right religion are not very well trained. So that's caused the problem, and al-Sadr has capitalized on this by keeping his forces in the shrine. I think he has left the shrine now because he wants to stay out of the way of the U.S. forces. But if he could, the fact that it's caused the U.S. so much problem, I think, is raised al-Sadr's status in Iraq, and that's not a good thing for the coalition. He vacates the shrine, his power base is really in Sadr City, which is a Shiite slum in the suburbs of Baghdad, and so he'll still be a force to be reckoned with.
Do you think we face the same problem in Najaf that we did in Fallujah a few months back, where we can't really take control of the city without killing so many people that it's counterproductive? I mean, we basically just gave them Fallujah back and said, okay, never mind.
Well, you know, this is turning into a Vietnam in that there's crazy things going on. Like in a war, eradicate the other side. And as U.S. Grant once said, you know, you have to, if the army's out there, you got to fight it.
All right, we'll be right back. Let's go to this break and we'll be right back. Hi, everybody. I'm Scott Horton, and welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Ivan Elin, the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. Sir, at the break, we were talking about the parallels that are beginning to take shape between the Vietnam War and the current situation in Iraq in terms of basically any real quote-unquote progress that we make is actually counterproductive.
Well, we're sort of half in and half out again. I mean, when people say that it's not really Vietnam, they focus, well, you know, this is urban warfare and Vietnam is jungle. But what we really need to focus on is the fact that the enemy has all the time in the world and we don't. We're eventually going to leave there, and they know that. And we've already made that clear from the start, I think. And, you know, we're not going to be an occupying power forever. We're going to leave one way or the other. And so that President Bush criticized Kerry for saying he would reduce the number of troops, but in fact, it's very obvious to the guerrillas, no matter who's president, Bush or Kerry, that the U.S. is eventually going to leave. And of course, you know, this wasn't obvious to the American colonists during the American Revolution because the British were ready to stay, but of course, even their public got tired of their overt formal colonial status. We have a somewhat less formal status in Iraq. We're still now in occupation, even though we're formally not in occupation. But the problem is that everyone knows that the U.S. gets tired and goes home, and we've even said that. And so the basic incentive here is to just hang on. All the guerrillas have to do is keep their army in the field and stay away from U.S. forces and keep up the mayhem. And, you know, they will have won this. We can win all the battles tactically that we want. And the military tends to focus on that. If you go to the Pentagon even today, they'll tell you that they won every battle in Vietnam and they lost the war. And the other parallel here is, and that's what's happening here, I think, our troops are much better than the, you know, the rabble that they're fighting, the guerrillas. But all the guerrillas have to do is get away from the U.S. forces, do hit-and-run tactics. And they're getting better all the time at doing that, and they can stay in the field. The other area I think where it parallels Vietnam is the fact that we're half in and half out. In other words, we can't just use our crack troops to just wipe the country off the map, wipe the enemy off the map, because we're going to wipe the population off too. And what we did in Vietnam was use excessive firepower. We've done that to some extent here, but there's more of a restraint because of the lessons of Vietnam. But the problem is, dust up over Najaf and Fallujah, as you mentioned before, are two cases in point. If the United States uses its forces to, you know, take over the shrine or in the past take over Fallujah, there'd be so much outrage they'd have to use heavy firepower, and they may, and in this case, damage the shrine. Of course, that wins the battle, but probably loses the war because everybody's so exercised over the shrine being damaged that, you know, you can never get a handle on. In guerrilla warfare, that's a problem. If you use too much force, you'll alienate the population. If you use too little force, you appear as weak. And the U.S. has appeared weak by not being able to take over either Fallujah or the shrine. And so the U.S. military is caught between a rock and a hard place, and it's not easy to get out. And frankly, the military, even after Vietnam, is not accustomed to fighting in this way. Their tradition goes back to U.S. Grant, where you annihilate the enemy, and you take his force from the field. And that's been the tradition of the U.S. military, using heavy firepower. And in guerrilla warfare, you just can't do that. And so, unfortunately, our troops aren't very well, and the equipment that we have, and the mentality, which is the most biggest problem, we don't really have the capacity to win this war, I don't think, because our military is, you know, still oriented to fight the nation state enemy of the Soviet Union.
What do you make about the fact that there are now 14 American bases being built in Iraq? It kind of seems that it's going to be hard for us to leave when we have 14 bases there. It seems like the conflict can go nowhere but beyond the borders.
Well, I personally believe that there's two reasons for doing this invasion, because the threat of Iraq wasn't that great, and people that are really tuned into that sort of thing realize that. So they were looking for ulterior motives, and I think the two ulterior motives that we have was to help out Israel by taking out an enemy, and second of all, to get bases to replace the Saudi bases that we were losing. Remember, the Saudis have asked us to leave because of the same problem. Infidel presence on Muslim soil creates this defensive jihad, which we see bin Laden and all the rest are fighting. And they believe it's defensive because they believe they're defending Islamic lands from the infidels. So we wanted bases along the Persian Gulf, but I can't imagine why they thought that invading another Islamic country was going to provide a stable situation for bases. They may be building these bases, but they're untenable if Iraq continues to be unstable. You can't have military forces, for use in other parts of the region, that is an outpost to guard Persian Gulf oil, if you're fighting a battle on your rear with guerrillas. So the country has to be stable. Right now, Saudi Arabia is stable, and Iraq is not. And so the problem that they're having is, even if they're constructing these bases, are they viable in the long term with this insurgency? Because we may have to leave Iraq as we did in Vietnam.
Well, let's hope it doesn't take 15 years like it did in Vietnam.
Well, my view is people say, well, you can't leave Iraq. And I say, well, that's what they said in Vietnam. And they use the credibility arguments. Whenever they pull out the credibility arguments, you're in trouble. And Vietnam, they use them. We have to stay in there to guard our credibility. Well, we would have had more credibility had we pulled out earlier rather than spending all those years in a quagmire. I think the same thing is happening here in Iraq. And I think if they allowed the Iraqis to have self-determination at the local level and gave them genuine democracy, the ability to determine their future, it wouldn't probably get the outcome that the U.S. government wants, but it would probably be a much more stable situation where we could withdraw our troops. And after we've uncorked this can of worms, we can't really put them back in the can, but we certainly can try to tame the situation and get out. And I think that's what we really need to do.
Do you think there's a reasonable chance that we could create some sort of self-government?
Well, I don't think we really ought to create anything for the Iraqis. I think we have to have the faith that they can do it themselves. And you say, well, there's all this violence, so how do we know they can do it themselves? Well, a lot of the violence is because of a foreign occupier is on an Islamic land. It's the same thing that motivated bin Laden to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan, to be motivated to get the U.S. out of Somalia, etc. And it motivates other Muslims. Plus, you have the Ba'athist holdovers from the Hussein regime. And then you have people who just are out of Iraqi patriotism, just don't want foreign occupiers walking around on their soil. I mean, if somebody would invade the United States, there would be some element of that here, I think, too. So you have these three groups, but I think basically another reason that they're – and if you take the foreign occupier away, that's going to reduce the violence a lot. The second reason that people are committing violence, particularly in the Sunni community – and also Al Sadr, is because they're afraid of being losing in the final settlement after the Americans leave. The Sunnis fear payback from the majority Shiites because the Sunnis rule Iraq since the Ottoman Empire, even during the Ottoman Empire, and so they've been ruling for a long time, and they're a minority, and they oppress the 65% Shiite majority, and the Sunnis are scared of payback. The Kurds are scared that they're not going to be able to retain the autonomy that they had, and the Shiites don't want to be oppressed again. So all of these groups want to get control of the Iraqi central government. Well, how do you stop that violence? Well, you make the central government very weak, and you either have a loose confederation or an actual partition, or maybe some combination of both where the Kurds secede and the Sunnis and the Shiites live in one country. But I think the Iraqis have to determine that for themselves. I think if they would be given local self-determination, they probably would end up choosing something like that, because I don't think the three groups particularly want to live in the same country together. Or if they do, they're going to try to get control of that central government because they think the central government is going to use it to oppress the other groups. So if you take that away, so I think the best chance for peace and prosperity in Iraq, and admittedly, now that we've uncorked this can of worms, there's no good option, but I think self-determination, that is genuine self-determination for the Iraqis, and also you know, U.S. withdrawal of forces would probably be the best and smartest both for the U.S. and for the Iraqis.
It's interesting how you bring up how the Shia, I mean, pardon me, the Sunni have been ruling since the days of the Ottoman Empire. Now, back when it was the Ottoman Empire, that region that I guess the British named Iraq or something, that region was divided into Basra, Baghdad, and Tikrit, and was three separate areas under the Ottoman jurisdiction, right?
Right, so that, there's more history of that than there is Iraq. Iraq was an artificial entity created by the British after World War I when the Ottoman Empire caved in.
Okay, hang tight right there. We'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. All right, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and our guest is Ivan Elin, the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty. You can check out independent.org or onpower.org and learn all about the Center on Peace and Liberty there at the Independent Institute. Mr. Elin, I saw it last week. The polls say that Americans still believe that Iraq had lots of weapons of mass destruction and that we found them all. And so that brings up the question to me that must be answered at this point. If the American people are going to insist on believing that, I think we need to confront the question, so what if they did have weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I'm not sure which poll you're mentioning, but certainly there haven't been any found. And but I always maintain that this is kind of a non-issue because, frankly, even if Saddam had, in the worst case, been shortly about to get a nuclear weapon, or who already had nuclear weapons as North Korea, which I think is a more unstable regime than Saddam was, and a kookier regime than Saddam was, North Korea already has nuclear weapons. Let's say that Saddam had a nuclear weapon. Well, you know, we have thousands of nuclear weapons, and both North Korea, Iraq, and any other country that gets nuclear weapons, these so-called rogue states, they all have addresses. And that's much different than a terrorist, which doesn't have an address, a home address, because you can threaten to incinerate their homeland if they use those. I mean, we decided against the preemption option on Russia and China when they became nuclear powers. And if you'll remember, China became a nuclear power, and it was pretty radical under Mao, radical communist. And we did away with that preemption option, and we used deterrence. And frankly, deterrence does work against nation states. Now, terrorists is a different matter, but I think the way to battle terrorism is to remove or at least reduce our target profile. If we don't meddle in countries specifically like Iraq and others, the motivation of terrorists to attack us in the first place is lower. And frankly, after the Cold War, we really don't need to meddle as much overseas because we don't have a powerful superpower enemy to battle.
Well, aside from, you know, America changing its policy and reducing our terrorism profile, as you said, that way, the argument went, you know, as you say, everybody knows Saddam Hussein had a return address that he wouldn't just nuke us because we'd nuke him back, but I think George Bush said that Saddam Hussein would give these weapons to terrorists, and then they could use them, and Saddam Hussein's fingerprints wouldn't be on it. And that's why it was necessary to invade first.
Yeah, that's another issue, but the problem with that argument is that that's very dangerous for Saddam to do, and you can trace where uranium comes from. So I think that... I think that Saddam had very little interest in doing that. And in fact, the CIA, in the most unbelievable thing before the war, the president's own intelligence agencies, the CIA, said that Saddam would be unlikely to use, because everyone was assuming that he had weapons of mass destruction, he would be unlikely to use his weapons of mass destruction or give them to terrorists unless the U.S. invaded Iraq and his back was against the wall. Then he would have no incentive to use restraint. So I think we actually embarked on the most risky alternative. Let's also explore Saddam's links to terrorism. He didn't really have that many links to terrorism. If you wanted to go after the big terrorist sponsors, you would go after Iran or Syria.
Which neither of them have ever attacked us either.
Right. But I'm just saying if the reason for this is that he's close to terrorists and he's got weapons of mass destruction. I would go, Iran is closer to getting a nuclear weapon, and they already have biological and chemical weapons, presumably, and they have many ties to terrorist groups. Iraq gave a few dollars to the families of Palestinian suicide bombers, but for the most part, Saddam supported only groups that attacked Israel, not the United States. And so, they keep saying, well, there was an Al-Qaeda group, affiliated group, Ansar al-Islam, in Iraq, but that was in Kurdish-held territory, and frankly, it was attacking both the Kurds and Saddam, so it wasn't friendly. They're totally distorting that. So Saddam's ties to terrorist groups were not that great, and the idea that he's going to give these weapons of mass destruction after spending millions and billions to get them to terrorist groups that could get him in trouble with and get his country incinerated by thousands of nuclear weapons from a superpower, strange credibility.
So if Iraq had warehouses full of chemical and biological and even nuclear weapons, then that still would not have justified our invasion of that country.
Well, no, I don't think so. We forget we have weapons of mass destruction. Other countries like Britain, France,
Israel.
So there's kind of a double standard to begin with. Now you say, well, these countries, these rogue states are dangerous, and we're not, and neither is Britain or neither is France. But the problem is that it's very difficult to attack these weapons. Clinton tried it in 1998. He was going to bomb these weapons, and they said first they said that he's going to eliminate the weapons of mass destruction. Then the Air Force got nervous. They were going to hold him to that, so they said, well, they're going to undermine his ability to make these weapons. Then they reduced it to, well, the Air Force leaked, people from the Pentagon leaked to the press, well, we really don't know where these weapons are.
So and they called it Operation Desert Fox. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Ivan Elin. He's a former investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and now is the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. You said that you thought the number one reason that we invaded Iraq was to take care of one of Israel's enemies. But then you also illustrated that Iran is far more dangerous to Israel than Iraq ever was. So why is it, do you think, that we went into Iraq instead of Iran, if that really was what we were there for?
Well, there's a couple of factors. First of all, I think that one of the main factors, there's a third factor, which I didn't mention, but which I forgot to mention, but I think is applicable. And I think if you read Bob Woodward's book, he went around and interviewed all the top players of the Iraq war decision. And it was very clear that even before the administration started, during the transition period, that Dick Cheney was agitated about Iraq and really wanted to hype the threat. He wanted to make sure that President Bush got the real threat briefings on Iraq, meaning them. Real bad threat briefings on Iraq.
Right. Real meaning the fake ones.
Yeah, well, he definitely wanted to bring home to the president that this was a big threat. And I think, frankly, he received a lot of criticism from conservatives for not finishing the job in the first Persian Gulf War, and that has driven him to, and I think also Bush's father received the same criticism, and I think this has affected Bush and Cheney when doing this. And so the other factor is I think Iran is a much tougher country. It's very mountainous. It's much larger in territory than Iraq. It is quite a regional superpower. We relied on the Shah of Iran to be our anchor there, and we picked the Shah for a very good reason. I mean, Iran is a very potent country in the region and always has been. And so you have this large country with many more people and with the mountainous terrain. It's much more difficult to do what was done in Iraq. I mean, Iraq is, for the most part, flat desert, And that's our kind of warfare. And it's much dicier in Iran. But I think both the fact that Iran's a harder nut to crack militarily, and also the fact that they were kind of focused on Iraq for these irrational reasons. I also remember that it was alleged that Saddam tried to assassinate Bush's father after he left office when he was on a tour of Kuwait. So that may have had a, I think there may have been some emotion in this, as, in addition to the factors, the analytical factors that I mentioned. We don't usually go to war for one reason, but there's usually several reasons. I think it's both the combination of emotion and the oil and the Israel factor.
Yeah, it's really too bad that the president doesn't read The New Yorker. He would know that that never really happened. Or whatever assassination attempt there was at Iraq.
Yeah, well, there's a lot. That's a whole other issue. There's not that much evidence to show that it was Saddam because these explosives, it's common wisdom that you hear people say all the time that, well, Saddam tried to assassinate Bush. When you say, well, he really wasn't affiliated with many terrorist groups, and the ones he did affiliate with were attacking Israel and Palestine, then people bring up, well, as it's a fact that this was a definite assassination attempt by Saddam on the to get the elder Bush. But if you look at the evidence, these explosives were fairly common. And, yeah, it could have been Saddam, but it could have been other people as well.
In fact, Frederick Whitehurst, the former director of the FBI crime lab, who actually did the test on the explosives, determined what they were made out of. And the government lied and said that they had identified an entirely different explosive altogether in order to try to tie it to Iraq. So,
Yes, well, there's a lot of doubt surrounding that, and so that may have been a factor in the president's, I think he's even made comments to that effect.
It's interesting when you talk about the wars kind of all come from a confluence of interests where it's not really one big reason, but usually like a few lesser ones, and it seems like there really was, in this case, a really extended confluence of interest here. It turns out we know now, I don't know what to what degree, but we know now that Ahmed Chalabi was working for Iran. And it sort of brings up the question, like, is this where Iran wants to get rid of Saddam Hussein, their annoying secular neighbor that they hate, and Israel wants to get rid of Saddam Hussein, their neighbor that they hate, and George Bush wants to get rid of him because he thinks that he tried to kill his daddy. And, I mean, we have, you know, the Halliburtons of the world, the Israelis and the Iranians all ganging up to get America into this stupid war.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, I think that's a good point. Oftentimes when we go to war, it's various interests that push us into the war rather than it being necessary for national security. We can see that the pro-Israeli lobby, the pro-oil lobby, as you mentioned, Iran, and that's the delicious irony, I think, here that the neoconservatives were probably duped by an agent of Iran.
They're so smart, though. You can't dupe a Richard Pearl. He's a philosopher king, Mr. Elon. You can't contradict that.
Well, I think that they got bamboozled by Chalabi, and given his past banking practices, they should have known that he's not the most reliable person to rely on when you're getting information from them. So I think that yes, for a number of reasons we were pulled into this thing, and unfortunately we're stuck there at least until we make the hard political decision that we're gonna get out and give the Iraqis self-determination at the local level so that they know that the Iraq central government isn't going to be used to oppress them, then I think that we're going to have a problem.
George Bush announced last week that he wants to withdraw 70,000 troops from their bases around the world. He wants to pull troops out of South Korea. He wants to pull troops out of Germany. What do you make of that?
Well, I think I support that, actually, but I think that one of the reasons that they're doing it is because they're strained. Iraq has put such a strain on the whole force because you've got 115,000 American troops there, and that's a lot of troops to have in one area. And these areas that we're taking them out of, they don't really need to be there in the first place. I mean, we have all these forces sitting in the middle of Germany, and the threat evaporated, and yet, you know, more than about a decade and a half after that threat evaporated, we still have the troops there. In South Korea, the situation is much different than when North Korea invaded South Korea in 1950. North Korea's economy is stagnant under an oppressive communist system, and the South Korea has a very vibrant economy over those years, and so now South Korea has almost 30 times the GDP that the North has, so they can really defend themselves. So I think that, you know, they recognize that all these forces aren't needed. And some of those 37,000, that's the total amount in Iraq, but they're pulling out, in South Korea, they're pulling out about one-third of the forces, and some of those forces are going to Iraq. So Iraq does have a role to play in this whole mess, the strain on the forces. And if you'll recall, Bush came into office criticizing Clinton for all these interventions overseas that put a strain on the military. Well, Bush has put an even bigger strain on the military after all that rhetoric about with this Iraq and the Afghanistan thing. And of course, we still got troops in Bosnia and Kosovo that were left over from Clinton.
Well, oh, yeah. Remember, they're going to be home by Christmas 95, which is
right
around the corner.
Yeah,
Clinton's
going to be home in a year, so, which no one believed even at the time.
Well, so the 70,000 troops, basically, Bush gets to sound good, like, hey, I'm bringing your son home from overseas. But what he's really doing is just kind of reshuffling them around to different places and maybe sending them to Central Asia and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that they're doing it is because they're not taking troops out of Iraq. And Kerry has said that he would bring some of the troops home from Iraq. So Bush is countering, well, hey, we're bringing them home, troops home too. But, of course, those troops in South Korea and Germany and wherever else in Europe are not going to be, are not being shot at and killed every day the way the troops are in Iraq. So it's kind of a, you know, bait and switch thing. He's saying that's one of the reasons he is doing it in addition to, I think it is a good idea to do it, but.
Just too bad they don't really mean it.
Well, I think they mean it, but the real problem with the whole program is that they're going to establish temporary bases in Eastern Europe, and they've already done so in Central Asia, and they're going to rotate troops through there. And, of course, that's a mistake, and that's going to the whole thing isn't going to save any money. It'll probably cost money, and adding these new bases overseas, even for a rotation place for U.S. to rotate in troops, is going to cost us money.
Mr. Elin, even if we assume, which I do, and I'm pretty sure you do from reading your columns, if we assume that the quote-unquote war on terror is a false start and the wrong way to go about things, that you can't really have a war against terror, that maybe if we're going to have a war against Al-Qaeda, like maybe if I could be that specific, how exactly would you propose going about having a war against Al-Qaeda or at least protecting the American people from Al-Qaeda without making matters
worse? Well, I think
worse.
The first thing that we need to do is make it against Al-Qaeda. We're also going after Hamas and Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is an organization in Lebanon that's very effective, but they don't really attack the U.S. anymore. They only did so when we were in Lebanon. And it's the same old problem, which is written right into the Quran, that Muslims will defend Muslim territory when it's attacked by by infidels. And of course, this happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Lebanon, it happened in Somalia, and now it's happening in Iraq. And so we don't ever seem to learn anything from this. So what we really need to do, we need to go after Al-Qaeda. Certainly they did attack us. But in the long term, we need to quietly reassess whether we need to be in some of these places, because it's just driving more jihadists, more fundamentalist Islamists into the jihadist and terrorist camp.
And that's not retreating, giving ground to the terrorists?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think people ask me that. And first of all, you don't attack somebody that didn't attack you. We attacked Iraq. We're now going after Hamas and Hezbollah. Al-Qaeda is the one that attacked us, so I have no problem with defending ourselves against that. But what I'm saying is we really ought to ask ourselves, whether we should be doing some of these policies. We ought to be asking ourselves this, whether there's any terrorist threat or not. Do we really need to be all over the world anymore in an imperial sort of fashion when we don't have a superpower enemy to fight anymore? There's a lot less positives to it now, and there's a lot more negatives with terrorists trying to attack our homeland. I mean, we, our foreign policy people, have created the largest threat we've ever faced here at home since the War of 1812. Even during World War II, there was less of a threat to the homeland. And if the first principle should be of any national security policy should be protecting the U.S. citizens and its homeland. We can worry about defending NATO and defending Europe and defending the Far East and, you know, meddling around in Iraq or whatever, but later. But the first line of defense should be defending our homeland, and we're actually putting at risk by these imperial policies. They're actually neo-imperial policies. We're not an empire like the British or French, but we do have an informal influence through military bases, alliances, economic sanctions, that sort of thing, all over the world. And we're the only country that intervenes regularly outside its own region. So that's what empires in the past have gotten blowback. But unfortunately, these modern communication and transportation and that sort of thing, computing, has given us terrorists who can, you know, kill masses of people on our own homeland. So I think we need to be a little bit more careful now. It's kind of like saying, you know, you're buying an expensive car and taking it into a really bad neighborhood and leaving it overnight. Now, if the people there in that neighborhood put it up on blocks, steal all the parts out of it, they should go to jail because they did something wrong. But should you have parked your car there in the first place, it's probably not wise to do. So I think to use that analogy here, Al-Qaeda needs to be prosecuted. We may even need to use military action in some cases, although I think we should do that covertly rather than overtly as we did in Afghanistan. We need to ask ourselves whether we really need to be in that bad neighborhood with our new Porsche, because we could probably just keep it home in the garage. And in fact, it's more like taking your Porsche to a bad neighborhood and running over people and then leaving it there.
Yeah.
Don't you think people are going to try to steal it and inflict some harm on you?
Right. Well, I think the thing is here with this analogy is that the Porsche was bought with tax money, and nobody really owns it because everybody owns it, and so nobody really cares about the Porsche at all.
Right. Well, the problem is there's a lot of interest groups that in Washington who like these interventions, and the bureaucracy, the government bureaucracy, and the foreign policy establishment are included in those interest groups. But as I mentioned, some of them earlier, that push for various interventions around the world. And so you're right, the taxpayer ends up paying for it. And the taxpayer ends up spending out all this money to be less secure instead of more secure. So when they haul out all these homeland security measures, wouldn't it just be cheaper if the terrorists didn't attack us in the first place? We wouldn't have to have all our civil liberties taken away. But nobody ever reaches this conclusion because it's too scary to... Number one, it's too scary to look at our own behavior. And if you look at the public opinion polls in Islamic countries, it reflects the fact that they don't like our policy. They like our culture, our values, our political and economic freedoms in poll after poll, but it's the policies that they don't like. And, you know, if we don't do something about that, we're going to continue to have this problem.
Yeah, and we keep invading nation after nation. And meanwhile, Mike Schurer, the formerly anonymous CIA author of the book Imperial Hubris, he wrote something or was interviewed or something in the Guardian newspaper last Friday saying that right now, today, there are 30 men assigned to hunting down Osama bin Laden. The guy who did it, that we have 30 guys tracking them around as the rest of our military is spread all over the world.
Right. Well, I always said it was like,
Oh, hang on. Hold that thought right quick until we get right back from this break. It's the last little break here. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. The guest is Ivan Elin from the Center on Peace and Liberty. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show for Saturday, August the 28th, 2004. I'm out of town, so this is a recording. The guest is Ivan Elin. He's the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. Look up independent.org and onpower.org. And his brand new book coming out is The Empire Wears No Clothes. Now, let's see here. I was going to ask you, oh, yes, you wrote this very interesting column for Antiwar.com last week asking the question, is it in our government's interest to protect us from terrorism?
Yes, first, my book is going to be is called The Empire Has No Clothes.
Oh, Has No Clothes, my bad.
Yeah, the full title is The Empire Has No Clothes, U.S. Foreign Policy Exposed. But anyway, yes, I did write that column, and I think it's very important. There's a thing called the public choice economic theory, and also political scientists agree with this also, that when the public is not watching, the public and the taxpayer vested interests go to Washington and they get hold of a policy, and they're more organized. And what you have is concentrated benefits to those groups, and the costs are diffused to all of us taxpayers, and so they end up legislating what they want, or getting what they want one way or another, and the taxpayer ends up footing the bill. And the taxpayer doesn't squawk too much because it's only a few cents. The problem is after you pile program on program on program, then you have a huge federal government like we have, and we have high taxes, and most of these programs are, and this happens both domestically, and I think many you know, conservatives, libertarians, and economists have focused on the domestic aspects. But this happens even more so in the foreign policy sphere because the public pays even less attention to foreign policy than it does domestic policy. And so what we have in this in our foreign policy is one group or this group or that group petitioning the government to intervene overseas. I'll give you an example. Bill Clinton was very unenthusiastic about expanding NATO until he discovered that about 5% of the voters 5 to 10% of the voters in key Northeast Midwest states were from Eastern Europe, and they were actually the swing voters in the swing states. So they're a very important voter group. So of course, the main steps to expand NATO happened in the election years. If you go back, you can look at, you can trace that. That's just one example. Another example is what we've been talking about. This invasion of Iraq was probably driven by indirect subsidy to oil companies, and also as a way to take out one of Israel's major opponents. And so, but is this in our best interest? Invading an Islamic country, creating more terrorists than we already had. So I think that...
well, your point is that it is in their interest in this case.
In the group's interest, but it's
the invasion of Iraq couldn't have happened without September 11th, and maybe the invasion of Iran can't happen without one more.
Well, I think that's right. The groups take advantage of these types of things. And another example is Bush's ludicrous statement before, I think it was the Cattlemen's Association, that beef subsidies are required for national security. because after all, we have to eat, and I thought, boy, I'm not going to pay any attention to what President Bush says on national security anymore.
Oh man, I'm sorry.
Using it to take advantage of that to get the subsidies for beef farmers.
Right. Okay. Well, we are straight out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show, Mr. Elin. Everybody,
okay,
Ivan Elin is the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty, and the book is The Empire Has No Clothes.